Welcome to this edition of the Third Opinion Podcast. If you haven't yet, please subscribe to the Third Opinion wherever you get your podcasts. Quite a show this week, a little Hanukkah celebration, and an interview with Tampa Bay Lightning owner Jeff Vinnick. So let's get started. Here's this week's Third Opinion.
Good afternoon, or good morning, or good evening, whenever you're listening to this. This is the Third Opinion, Two Jews, Three Opinions. I am Mike Deason.
I'm Lorene Jaffe.
And we got to start off because we've had this controversy. We will probably
for weeks now. I'm sure until the inauguration day.
Till January 20th. Okay. So by now, when most people are hearing this, the Electoral College will have elected Joe Biden as the president-elect of the country. Now, January 6th is when it goes to Congress. Are you still believing that Biden will not be inaugurated on January 20th?
It's not saying that I believe that he will not be. What I'm saying is that I believe there are real constitutional issues and there are questions out there. So he's still the supposed or the presumed president-elect. But I think even this week we saw, you know, the state of Texas filed an action with the United States Supreme Court, which the U.S. Supreme Court has original jurisdiction. And you had 18 other...
That's such a frivolous lawsuit, Lorene.
I mean, you know what? You say that, but apparently 18 other attorney generals who joined that don't think so. And then from 18 other states, then you also have members of Congress from Ohio who joined in. You have state legislators from Pennsylvania as well as Michigan
There's 100 U.S. congressmen, 106, I think. But it's
it's 100. I know.
The thing is, why should Texas tell? Let's say Florida was one of the states that they were looking at. Okay, we're not, but say that was included in the suit. Why should Texas have the right to tell Floridians we don't like how your election was run when the Constitution allows the states to set up the elections?
Well, actually, so it runs within the state legislators, their question there is, did the way that it was done, does it violate the U.S. Constitution? I mean, that's the question before the United States Supreme Court right now. And it is relevant. It's irrelevant. And I say this again, it doesn't matter what party you are a part of. This is not a partisan issue. The question is a fundamental constitutional question, because they're saying that if these four states engaged in conduct that was unconstitutional when it comes to our United States elections, and then we can see every state doing this, then it does disenfranchise the people of our state of their vote. And that's what they're saying. And I get that. I'm not going to discount and say it's not an important argument. Let the U.S. Supreme Court decide.
Do you think the Supreme Court's going to take the case? I do not.
I absolutely do. Definitely.
They're going to dismiss it because they dismissed that other suit with one sentence. They are not going to take
the one, right? The one that Alito had warned them on. I mean, right. I actually think they will, because you now have pretty much almost every state minus, I think, 10 or 12. So you have
states that are accused in it say we ran it. Their courts have said we everything was run correctly. I think.
But the problem with that is that legislators from Michigan and Pennsylvania have joined in and have said that's not so, and we are trying to take back our constitutional authority, but we don't have a way to do it in the time that's provided before the inauguration. And so here's our only opportunity to come before you, court, to say we need you to intervene in our state. So I'm gonna say the court's going to take it, and we're going to come back to this next week, and we'll see where things stand.
I think the court will decide before Monday, the 13th, and a lot of people will be listening to this afterwards, but we don't have a decision. This is Friday we're taping. Because of the Electoral College meeting.
But you know, the thing about the Electoral College is the only date that's actually referenced in the United States Constitution is the inauguration date. So there can still be decisions made after the Electoral College meets. And this is the other thing, you know, you have to think about you know, there are, like right now in Michigan, for instance, and even in Arizona, they're doing forensic audits of Dominion software. There's so much going on. There are over six states that that are at issue that the legislatures are regularly engaging in day-long hearings, taking in fact testimony, taking in expert testimony. They're looking at these issues. Most of this, for the most part, for instance, you and I were just talking yesterday, was what, December 10th? Again, Georgia, their third legislative body, all-day hearing, 8 hours.
And probably not going to hear about it. And Secretary of State have all said.
But hold on. But you're probably not going to hear about this because it's not the governor or the Secretary of State that has the responsibility. It's actually the state legislators constitutionally had the responsibility for fair elections and to ensure that they're properly applied according to the U.S. Constitution. So, again, another 8-hour hearing yesterday was testimony was taken. You're not going to hear about it in the media, but there are relevant issues that are being talked about and real issues. Like I saw, for instance, Coffee County, Georgia, decided they weren't going to recertify based upon the recount. And they had Coffee County, one of the women who worked for supervisor elections there, actually demo Dominion software for the committee yesterday in Georgia. And what was interesting about that, when you watch a demo, is that she can, contrary to what Dominion has said, is that she was able to change votes electronically. So number one, there's no record of what the original vote was. So it's gone. So even if you did a recount, you would never know what the original vote was, and you could change it electronically. And that is, those are problems. Those are real issues.
Aren't there voting software? Aren't there paper backups?
No, not where electronic votes are. You don't get it.
Sure. The machines have paper backups.
But she's scanning them in, and she could decide, I'm going to choose X or Y. And on this one, it's a blank ballot, and I'm going to go ahead and fill it in. So if you're not doing, but you're assuming they're doing actual hand counts, like they're not doing full hand counts of the paper ballots. That's not what they've been doing. They've been doing the tabulating machines. So it's a limited audit. So unless you do full hand recounts,
they did some hand counts. I mean,
but not full. It was a risk audit.
Okay,
wait. Full.
Just because I don't want to belabor because we got a lot of other things. But do you think that the votes were actually changed?
Okay, so I want to be really clear here. Every single Democrat in the state of Georgia opposed the bill in Georgia last year that would have allowed Dominion software. And the reason for it is because of the risk that Dominion software posed for these specific issues. So yes. And by the way, they're not the only ones. Many lead Democrats in the U.S. Congress have also opposed this type of software over the years because of the problems that exist with it. So all of a sudden, they're all silent right now. But the problem is this, is that we're seeing real issues, and these are things that need to be vetted and investigated. Whether
Republican legislature, which won handily in Georgia and also just nationally in Congress and in the Senate, how did they all get elected if the Democrats were manipulating it and Trump didn't?
Hold on. I'm not saying the Democrats were manipulating that Trump didn't. You're not hearing me. What I'm saying is that there are real issues. So whether it impacts this election or not, these are questions that are being addressed right now because it's very clear that the software can be manipulated. And that should not be the case. If you put your vote in, you should know your vote is your vote.
I just don't believe it. Lorraine, to me, it sounds Trump lost. Trump lost the election.
This isn't about, but you're not hearing me. Everybody keeps going, this is Trump. No. This is bigger than Trump. If you're going to be myopic that way, then you're missing the bigger problem that exists and the responsibility of the state legislatures in addressing these issues to ensure that you can't have votes that can be manipulated. Let's go back to paper ballots then. Let's not have computer systems where you can manipulate and change things. Like that causes problems. You need to have a system where that cannot happen. And that, you know, like, and people are not talking about this. They're like, oh no, they're putting their heads in the sand. So let's forget about the 2020 election for a minute and think bigger and stop being so limited in our viewpoints and understand there are real issues right now. Well, I mean, real issues.
Okay, we'll see by next week. So we'll put it aside. I don't think the court's going to take it. You do, and we'll see. Next week we'll probably have a better handle on this.
But by the way, I don't think Vegas has called it because there are a lot of people who bet money in Vegas. And I don't think Vegas has even called the election yet. I'm just saying.
I'm not a gambling. I'm not a gambling guy. Hey, listen. One big thing that happened this week that just happened is Morocco and Israel.
That's huge. I'm so excited about this. So the Trump administration, you know, we talked about this, about the peace deals, right? Like him or not, it doesn't matter. Like, first of all, we've got Bahrain, we've got the UAE, Sudan, and now Morocco. And I got to tell you, I mean, I love Morocco. I like Morocco. The Jews have been in Morocco for 2,000 plus years. And so to see this relationship, you know, blossom and have these formal ties now and part of the Abraham Accords with Morocco is so exciting. And you know, the king of Morocco also, I mean, he very much loves the Jewish people. He's been wanting to do this for a long time. So I am very excited about this. I mean, to see this, you know, again.
It's a good thing. But did you see that Benny Gantz and the people in his party were not told by Netanyahu about this? They learned about it from the United States. The relationship in Israel. I mean, I think we have fractious politicians here. Holy cow!
They got real issues. Which, by the way, I mean, look, we still don't know if they're gonna have another election. It all depends if they could do a budget or not, right?
Well, yeah.
And so,
but somebody from the Likud party just resigned. Who's going to run? Again, they're figuring another election,
right? So, well, you know what's so interesting about this? So that's Sa'ar, right? So Sa'ar, who obviously has been, you know, one of Netanyahu's stalwarts for a long time, you know, rose up in the party under Netanyahu, has decided, you know, and I've had enough of Netanyahu. I want to run my own party. And, you know, which, by the way, the problem with this is if that happens and we do go to re-election, it's going to be the same exact thing would happen with Avigdor Lieberman. Remember, Avigdor Lieberman did the same thing, leaving the Likud, and it caused all this, and we ended up in three elections. So I think
Israel just has an election every year. That's all. I mean, it's just like it's like an annual holiday. And speaking of an annual holiday, here we are.
One right now.
Hanukkah. So yeah, let you know.
Eight crazy nights. So Thursday night, December 10th was the first night we lit the menorah. So eight crazy nights. We love Hanukkah. But you know, quick description. Because the Maccabees, you know, Judah, you had the Hellenistic Jews, the Syria Jews, the Hellenistic Greeks and they were pagans and they worshiped all kinds of gods, whatever. And they wanted Judas to slaughter a pig on the altar of God. And he said no. And then when the Hellenistic Greek pagan priest went to go slaughter a pig on the altar of God, he struck him down. And then he ran for his life. And then his sons and his brothers, they all joined. And in essence, they rose up against the Hellenistic Greeks to fight back, which was, and this, by the way, was like in the year 174 before Common Era, so 174 BCE. And I love it. So the word Maccabee comes from Mi Kamocha Belim Adonai, which means who is like you among all powers, God. And so, you know, they call him Judah the Maccabee. But that was their, in essence, their battle cry when they would go to war against the Hellenistic Greeks, the occupiers that were, you know, who didn't let Jews, like, the thing about them is, you know, obviously, you know, desecrating the Holy Temple, but, you know, they were murdering, they were killing women who would circumcise their children. You were not allowed to observe any mitzvot. You were, the observance of Judaism was completely forbidden, punishable by death. And so, you know, it's just, it really, you know, that the defeat of the Hellenistic Greeks, along with the rededication of the temple, were multiple miracles. So I love that.
Yeah, I do too. You know what? The Hanukkah is the only of the holidays that have become a major holiday, although it's not mentioned in the Bible at all.
I know. It's so crazy. And, you know, well, it's not a Yom Tov, right? It's not one of the holy days, the appointed times, but it's like we celebrate it because kind of like Purim, which Purim is mentioned in the book of Esther, but like, kind of like Purim, it's like we defeated this awful empire that sought our full destruction as a Jewish people. And it's, you know, and it, again, it's, you know, as they say, they came to destroy us. We won. Let's eat.
I also think to have Jewish kids be able to feel part of the holiday season because of Christmas and all, that it was elevated more of an important holiday. And when I was a kid, I mean, that was, to me, the most important Jewish holiday, you know, when you're a little kid, you know. When I was last night lighting the candles with my grandchildren, you know, my three-year-old was just like, whoa, and, you know, and so Yeah, it for kids, it is the most important. But I think it was elevated because of that. You know, we have we have a terrific Hanukkah song from a group called the Maccabees. I just love these guys.
I love them too.
And they just sort of capture the essence of it. If this doesn't make you smile, there's something wrong with you. Let's listen to the Maccabees and their take on Hanukkah.
I'll tell a tale, 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 yeah. Of Maccabees in Israel, L, 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 yeah. When the Greeks tried to assail, sail, 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 yeah. But it was all to no avail, veil, 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 yeah, yeah. The war went on and on and on until the mighty Greeks were gone, yeah.
I put my lockers in the air sometimes, saying hey, oh, spin the dreidel. Just wanna celebrate for all the nights, singing hey, oh, light the candle. We say I'll have me sing, oh yeah, for all eight nights. Then we play dreidel by the candlelight. And I told you once, now I told you twice, about the miracle of the candlelight.
They took the field, 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 field. Their rivals thought, are they for real, 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 real? Those Maccabees, they never yield, 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 yield. They charged ahead with sword and shield, 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 shield. Yeah, yeah, the war went on and on and on until the mighty Greeks were gone, yeah.
I put my lockers in the air sometimes, saying, hey, oh, spin the dreidel. Just wanna celebrate for all late nights, singing hey, oh, light the candle. We say ma, oh, soon, oh yeah, for all late nights. Then we play dreidel by the candlelight. And I told you once, now I told you twice, about the miracle of the candlelight.
And the great menorah for 8 days kept on burning. What a celebration, a great return to Torah learning. Cause I can feel it, and I Neis Gadol, Neis Gadol, Neis Gadol Hayasham, Neis Gadol Hayasham, Neis Gadol Hayasham, Sham, Sham, Sham.
I put my lockers in the air sometimes, saying hey, oh, spin the dreidel. Just wanna celebrate for all late nights, singing hey, oh, light the candle. We say ma, oh, soon, oh yeah, for all late nights. Then we play dreidel by the candlelight. And I told you once, now I told you twice, about the miracle of the candlelight.
Those guys are really talented. Those guys.
They really are. I know. I love them. Yeah. I love their music. But I have to say, my favorite Hanukkah song, because last year at Hanukkah, we played like various versions of Adam Sandler's Hanukkah song. But my favorite personal Hanukkah song is Matisyahu with the Miracles. I love his
Miracles. We played that. We played that last year.
I think we did. Yeah, I think we did.
I hadn't heard of him. You're the one that sort of turned me on to him, but I was not aware of him. But anyway, it's nice to celebrate Hanukkah, a happy time, and everybody likes it. Did you see? Did I send you the thing about the little girl who had her hair
yes,
caught on fire when Clinton was president? The video
back in the day, long time ago.
It's worth going on YouTube and Googling this. But there's a bunch of Jewish kids in the Oval Office. Clinton is wearing a kippah and looks very comfortable with it. And they're lighting the menorah, and the back of her hair catches on fire, and he puts it out. It's worth seeing. She's now an attorney, but doesn't like lighting the candles at home, goes to other people's houses.
I don't know that she was traumatized. I mean, she didn't say it was traumatized. Like, she actually didn't really. She's like, ah. Yeah. You know, but We should also mention the Foo Fighters, for those of you who are Foo Fighter fans. So the Foo Fighters decided this year for Hanukkah, they're doing like a Hanukkah season, series. So for every night of Hanukkah, they're the Foo Fighters lead singer David Grohl and the Jewish producer Greg Kurstin are going to be doing a new song by a famous Jewish rock star and releasing that on their website. So you can, you know, kibbutz over that with the Festivals of Lights, listening to them doing some new songs for you to celebrate Hanukkah with. So
maybe
I can make that kind of
maybe
cool.
Yeah, maybe we can get a compilation of that next week. That would be a cool thing to do.
It is, and we also have to remember, obviously, last Hanukkah was that horrific attack, not only in the kosher market in Jersey City, but then the awful hate crime, the attack of the rabbi, the people in his home in Muncie, New York, on the seventh night of Hanukkah. So you know, we had two awful attacks last year around this time. So, I think what did you see that one story though about what they did?
The Anne Frank House? I
was going to talk about the table. So they took the table. So the Muncie rabbi, when he was on the seventh night of Hanukkah, and he had all the people over in his home for a Hanukkah celebration. So and one of the people who was attacked, that knife attack, died. So what he did, he took the coffee table. He had picked up the coffee table in his house and he threw it at the attacker to stop the attack, to get him out of the house. So they have now made that coffee table into a menorah stand for Hanukkah. That. And they sort of did the decoration of the dreidel on it. So the inscription, the dreidel, is on each of the four sides. And I thought that was just like a really nice memorial, to remember.
I didn't see that. No, what I was talking about was the desecration of the Anne Frank memorial in Boise, Idaho, where there are a lot of very radical folks in Idaho.
I mean, I would never think that Idaho.
I know. Idaho?
It's so crazy. That was so sad. I think, Mike, right? I think that's the only statue memorial to Anne Frank in the country.
Really? Well,
they
put swastikas all over it. It was just. Have you ever been to the Anne Frank House in Amsterdam?
I've never been. No.
Wow, Lorene, it was chilling. I couldn't talk after, thinking of them. I mean, you're in the actual place where they were hiding and living in fear. I honestly couldn't talk as I was standing there. It was very moving. If you ever get a chance, I highly recommend that. One other thing about Hanukkah, I don't know, you sent it to me or I came across it when they're talking about the the things you need to know about Hanukkah, that there was a sect of Judaism teaching, the Hillel sect, which we know more about, and the Shamari, is that how you pronounce it?
Shamari?
Their belief was that you start the menorah with eight candles and take one away each night, as opposed to the way we do it.
The house of Hillel and the house of Shammai. So these are obviously
Shammai.
Okay. Two different rabbis who had large followings during the Second Temple days, but after. So the question of like, how do we like the menorah? So there's all these, you know, what's the right way? You know, so there's a lot of questions about it. So I guess you have to decide which one you want to follow. I just like the menorah. You know, share the light, spread the light, be light. That's what you're supposed to do this season.
Spread,
be the light.
Spread the light, be the light. Yeah, I like it. It is. It's still one of my favorite holidays, although it's all for the kids, and that's my favorite part. Hey, we have an unbelievable interview with a superstar in Tampa Bay, Jeff Vinnick, who owns the Lightning, who's changing the face of the Tampa Bay area. And I want to get...
Well, I should say it's two superstars, because Doug Cohn, who is a personal close friend of mine, he and his wife, I absolutely love them. I adore them.
They introduced you and your husband, didn't they?
They sure did. But, you know, they're a matriarch and a patriarch in our community. They're so philanthropic. They love the Jewish community. They're such good people. And so I say we have two community heroes. Obviously, Jeff Vinnick, who has been extraordinarily philanthropic himself, he and his wife, Penny, also the owners of the Stanley Cup championship team. Yay!
Well, Doug interviewed Jeff during when he was presented the Doug and Maureen Cohn Award for Community Participation. And we want to get to that, but first we've got to take a break. We'll be right back with the Vinnick interview. You are listening to The Third Opinion. Two Jews, Three Opinions.
An interview with Tampa Bay Lightning owner Jeff Vinnick is coming right up. You know, the Third Opinion podcast has interviewed lots of interesting people over the last year, and you can get them all at our archives at thethirdopinionpodcast.com. That's our website. You can also find out more about our hosts, Laureen Jaffe and Mike Deason, and leave us a comment or suggestion. It's all at thirdopinionpodcast.com. Let's get back to Third Opinion.
Welcome back to The Third Opinion. I'm Mike Deason.
Laureen Jaffe.
Now, we're talking about the Jeff Vinnick interview where he won the Doug and Maureen Cohn Award. You were in that Zoom event, right? Because I thought I heard you talking.
Yes.
I was not. So why don't you talk a little bit about that, and we'll get to the interview.
Right. So there really is a beautiful award for like a community leader within the Jewish community. And Doug Moore and Cohn, are sponsors of it. And last year went to Brian Glazer. This year went to Jeff Vinnick. And I think so appropriately. I mean, not only obviously he was a huge sponsor and of the Brian Glazer family, JCC here in Tampa, but even as an owner, for instance, of the Lightning, he has been so philanthropic. Like for most people who don't go to Lightning games. My husband and I, thank God, we're season ticket holders. We're very grateful for that. But he gives away $50,000 to a charity like every week. You know, to every game. Every game, there's like a new community hero where he honors people in the community. And that's just one of countless ways that he is so philanthropic and giving back to this community. And he has been so essential to really to FIBA, the Florida Israel Business Accelerator, in helping us, you know, not only sponsoring it, but helping us grow it, introductions, just everything.
And investing in it, too, as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So
he's involved in STEMRAD.
That's right. And I mean, just really the honor was very well deserved, well given. I mean, I think you look at these giants. I mean, Doug and Maureen are giants on their own right. But then obviously you have Brian Glazer, now Jeff Vinnick. I mean, they're just tremendous giants in our community. So
and,
really grateful to have them.
Here's Doug Cohn during that award presentation talking to Jeff Vinnick. Doug, take it away.
You and Penny have now been in Tampa Bay for about 10 years, and you've gotten a lot of publicity. But I don't think everybody quite understands where you came from, what you were doing before, and what brought you to Tampa Bay.
Prior to coming here 10, 11 years ago, buying the Lightning, I've always been in the money management business my whole life. Lived up in Boston for about 25 years. Worked at Fidelity Investments as an analyst and then a portfolio manager. Had my own hedge fund, Vinnick Asset Management, which actually went 2-3 years after I bought the Lightning. And always been very analytical. I try to treat solve any problem with analytics. A problem such as when I was turning 50 years old, wanted to know, what am I going to do for fun for the rest of my life? I'm turning 50, don't like playing golf, want something that'll be really exciting. And being in the hedge fund business, you know, my goal is to make money. Now, most of my clients were foundations, endowments, so that was a good cause. But there's nothing like being able to grow a business and make an impact on a community. And that's really been act two for both me and Penny for the last now 10 years and counting, which is why we love being so much part of this Tampa Bay community.
Great. So once you decided to buy the Bolts and you knew you were buying one of the worst teams in hockey, what strategies and philosophies did you employ to turn it into the great organization it is now? Some say the best franchise in all of sports.
Well, thank you. I hopefully we're pretty good at that. Hire great people and get out of the way. That's the honest truth of the strategy that I've employed, and that's the strategy I would tell anybody to use in a business that they are not an expert in. the team was in difficult shape 12 years ago. The brand was in difficult shape here in Tampa Bay. Honestly, if I know now what, if I knew then what I knew now, I probably would not have taken such a risk because it was rough. But, you know, between hiring really good people, Todd Leiwicki, Steve Griggs, Julian Brisebois, Steve Eisenman, John Cooper, and I can go on and on throughout the whole organization and letting them do their job. Honestly, when I meet a new owner of, in sports in any team, I tell them, don't pick the players. I have yet to see a situation in sports where a new owner comes in, picks players, and they have success. It never works. And in the business side, whether it's the hockey side, again, hire great people to get that job done. And then you have to give them the authority. You have to give them the latitude to do it. You can set the strategy with them. You can set the budget with them. But you got to let them do their job and not interfere. Otherwise, you know, great people need to have that blank canvas to paint on to do their jobs. I should add James Nozar on SBP, the real estate company, too. Another terrific leader I've been able to hire. So really, again, the formula was simple, but the other part of it that I could not have anticipated and is the secret sauce is this community. And it's just a wonderful place, this Tampa Bay area. So welcoming to me, to Penny, to our family. So open to new ideas, open to the, you know, the resurrection of the Lightning brand. The support we've gotten for the Lightning, for, you know, for the real estate, for the transportation referendum from 2 years ago, which we're hoping the Supreme Court votes thumbs up on, Florida Supreme Court. The support the community has given here, and the number of thanks yous I get is just incredible. And I am, and Penny is so appreciative and thankful for having picked a great place to relocate to and a great community to be part of.
So there you were, because of COVID, limited to watching your team on television from Boston in the finals of the Stanley Cup playoffs. Tell me how you felt with your team leading Dallas Stars 2-0 and the game clock ticking down towards zero. Maureen and I were watching, and we were nervous as hell. How did
Yeah, Doug, that was game six. And, you know, we were up 3-2. So we did have another game. We did not want to go there, having lost game five. The honest truth is I was pretty calm. And for whatever reason, from the beginning of the second round, we beat the Bruins in the second round. I believe it was the second game there. We had three really bad luck situations go against us in the first period. We were down 2-0 after losing game one, and a goal was called back, and there was a controversial goal that they got, and then there was something else, a penalty of some kind. We had tremendous bad luck. We came back and won that game, which showed a level of poise and experience that I've never seen out of our team. Honestly, I knew then that we were going to win the Stanley Cup. I just said, I know our guys have it this year. We have the talent, we have the grit, we have the mental fortitude to survive 65 days in a bubble. We were going to win the Stanley Cup. And I was relatively calm from that point forward. You know, overtime goals, you get excited and you stand up. And so, that calmness, that confidence I had never went away. Now, to be fair, I could have been wrong. So it's been a lost game. We could have had guys get injured. We could have not had Stamkos have that magical moment when he scored in 2.5 minutes of play when he shouldn't have been on the ice because he was too hurt. So incredible amount of good fortune went our way. But our guys were mentally focused. Coming off last year's devastating 4-game sweep in the first round, after having the best record in the history of hockey in the regular season, just to frame this, you have never seen a more determined bunch of players, coaches, entire staff. And we were on a mission, and I'm proud to say that we accomplished it.
Next, we'll move on to a new subject. So can you share with us how and why, right in the middle of your efforts to rebuild the Lightning, you jumped big time into real estate. Tell us, did the Gates folks come looking to invest with you or come to invest in Tampa? Or did you have to fly to Seattle and convince them that a major downtown development in Tampa, Florida was a deal of a lifetime?
You know, you don't wake up one day and say, for somebody that has zero commercial real estate experience, I'm going to go build a $3 billion development. It's not how it works. You want to know how it works. In this case was, the county owns the building where we are, where the arena is, but we control that and a couple of parking lots on either side. Now one of which is the JW Marriott Hotel, which is going to open in a couple of weeks. So that was it. Across the street, a small parcel of land right across the street from the front door of the arena becomes available for sale at prices of about 30 cents on the dollar versus the peak, you know, pre-real estate crash here. So it's right across the street, and all of us strategic minds got together and decided, you know what, we should buy that piece. It's right across the street. And then another contiguous piece of real estate comes available. And it's like the same minds gather again. You know what? We should buy that real estate. Piece by piece, at what we thought were very reasonable long-term prices. And I remember thinking at the time, as two pieces became five, became 10, all contiguous, I have no idea what we're going to do with this land. But someday we might want to develop it, or it's going to go up in value because it's downtown in a great growing city. So eventually we accumulated all this land, 50 acres worth and growing a little bit, and just started doing a lot of reading and talking to people about movement back to the urban core, from millennials, from empty nesters, et cetera. And obviously that's been interrupted right now during COVID. I don't think for one second people are going to lose their desire to live in cities and all the amenities that come with living in cities. So I have no doubt that while work from home may be a little higher in the future than it's been in the past, I have no doubt that New York and Tampa are going to do great in the years ahead. So we got educated to this and learned, and eventually said, you know what, we're going to, in 2014, we had a big showing. We have decided we're going to do $1 billion real estate development. And I remember to this day telling people, because I was so naive at real estate, $1 billion, and we're going to be done by 2018. Probably would have been bad if we were done then, because then we'd have all these empty buildings trying to fill up during COVID. Most of them are coming out over the next year. So at that point, we started to think even bigger about what kind of a district we could create downtown with water features and galleries and dozens of restaurants of different kinds and retail and residential. And eventually the USF Medical School was a big part of that, and hotels, and we can go on, and great streetscape experiences, two-way traffic, eating outdoors on the side of the road, walking on the Riverwalk in Okeechobee Park. Started to think about this, and it's like, this is bigger than what we thought. And this is an opportunity in the middle of a downtown, in a city, in an urban setting, surrounded by water on three top sides. This doesn't exist other places. So we started dreaming bigger, and Todd Leiwicki, CEO of Lightning at the time, had a very good relationship with Michael Larson, who is CEO, head of Gates Investment. And the partnership was meant to be from day one. We saw eye to eye. It took a few months to structure something that's complicated. And we have agreed on the vision ever since that day. And, you know, $1 billion became $2 billion, became $3 billion, became we don't know what at this point in time. Again, our phase one is about 80% done. That's a full $2 billion of development. We have high aspirations as we go forward. You know, so my answer to that is my answer to a lot of things that I get involved with. You know, I say yes, or I say maybe there's a good idea there, and it just kind of evolves over time or grows over time. And, you know, a lot of things I do wrong too. And Just to be fair, last year I lost my mind. I restarted my hedge fund and took in outside money. I did that for 6 months, couldn't bring in as much money as I wanted because of how difficult the climate was. My performance was fine during that period of time. And I shut it down after 6 months. And I said, thank God I didn't bring in the money. There's no way I had time to do that. So, you know what? I'm not afraid to take chances, and they don't always work out, but
well, there's no doubt that you're not afraid to take chances. You certainly have demonstrated that over and over again.
Yeah, most have worked out, but not all.
So we got two more subjects to cover. So next, I'd like to touch on a really important part of your life, and that is your philanthropic activities. So you've given away millions of dollars to lots of different causes. Can you tell us and tell the audience your personal philosophy regarding philanthropy, and what guides you in what you pick to give to and how much?
Well, I could ask the same question of you and Maureen. Doug, you guys have been so generous also. First thing I'd say, to be fair, is that Penny and I, we've been very fortunate in many years. I was very lucky that the thing I love to do, the stock market, I love so much, I happen to be good at also and happen to pay a lot. Doesn't always work out that way. In fact, Penny and I both say to our kids, become a teacher. That's more important than picking stocks, what I did. Educate young people. That, be a great teacher. But anyway, so we've been very fortunate. And being very fortunate, frankly, gives you the resources to be able to make a difference. And that's part of it. But really, when you talk about both of us and where it comes from, because we give away our money together and now we're getting our kids involved. It comes up to both of us to the way we were brought up. Both Penny's family, parents, my parents were very giving. They were giving with their dollars. They were giving with their time. We always gave to Jewish charities, Jewish causes growing up. And when I was in Boston also, and, you know, we what we like to give to actually has changed a bit over time, I would say. We love supporting the arts, but we even more so love supporting those who aren't so fortunate, whether that's in the area of education. We're involved in early learning and we're involved in setting up a charter school in Florida. Whether it's some of the exhibits that Penny and I have brought to Tampa that would have been free of charge for people to see to try to open their minds, whether that's due to COVID-related stuff where people just needed to pay month's rent or put a meal on the table. We both felt very, and our kids, we all talked about that during COVID. We both felt very strongly about that. So I think it's just kind of our DNA and the way we are wired, and without a doubt, it comes from our parents.
It's a beautiful thing. And we appreciate the leadership that you've shown in so many areas in your charitable giving. So I know your family, you and your family visited Israel for the first time this past 12 months. I think I tried to correspond with you and you said, I'm in Tel Aviv. So please share with us how your visit impacted you and the members of your family.
We had a fantastic time. We had a great down-to-earth guide with us the whole time who we could ask any question of. This wasn't one of those tours where you see prime minister, etc. This was a tour where, you know, you got to meet people of all kinds and just try to understand the way they live over there. This was without a doubt the most educational week of my life. Raw history and learning about that, as well as education, the way, different religions, different people who hate each other live within miles and just want the same thing, to have a good life for themselves and their kids. Just a phenomenal experience that will forever change all of us, and I'll never forget. And the last thing I will never forget is swimming in, what's the name? When we went swimming?
The Dead Sea.
The Dead Sea, of course. Swimming in the Dead Sea. Yeah, we floated. That was fun. All of that. We were the only ones in the water because it was about 35 degrees with 50 mile an hour winds. Getting out of the Dead Sea was the coldest I've ever been in my life. I remember that. Compares to a day at Sugarbush skiing when it was minus 20. But it was a lot of fun. It was with our family and, again, so educational. I learned so much about my heritage, faith, et cetera.
So cool. So moving on to actually another topic is that you've been a very generous contributor to the building fund for the Glazer JCC and a supporter of FIBA, the Florida-Israel Business Accelerator. And we know that you invested significant resources in STEMRAD, one of your companies that FIBA brought to Israel, brought from Israel to Tampa. Yep. What's your thoughts and feelings about how is the startups in Israel fit into the world of business?
Per capita, per square mile, per almost anything, Israel blows away the rest of the world in terms of innovation, venture capital, new ideas, entrepreneurship. Nothing close to it anywhere. The amount of talent over in Israel, the amount of, as I said, good ideas, the amount of companies being created and grown there. Obviously, though, Israel isn't the biggest market for what these companies are working on. So it's fantastic that the JCC and FIBA has been able to develop this relationship with companies over in Israel, and in some cases, like STEMRAD, actually bring them to the U.S., bring them to Tampa. And, Jim O'Connell, who you saw in the video before myself, we did a lot of work about trying to improve our entrepreneurial ecosystem in Tampa. We've started the Embark Collective headed by Lakshmi Shenoy, who's another great person that we've been able to find. And we have about 55 companies in our innovation hub in a great setting doing really well. And we're, again, for the whole region, we're trying to propel them to be better. And to really, the knowledge economy is where it's at for the next 10, 20, 30 years. And this area gets a B in terms of our efforts there. We need to move that to a B plus and an A minus and an A. So what we're doing there and what the JCC, what FIBA is doing is all part of this effort to really raise the bar on our, as I said, knowledge economy.
What a fascinating interview. What a fascinating interview. So let me tell you,
so true.
Vinick is a really stand-up guy. I have a personal story with him. I did a series of stories, I can't remember how many years ago, about Tim Markham, the head coach of the Tampa Bay Storm, who was sending out racist, sexist, and pornographic images over a company computer.
And, really?
Oh, yeah. He got
fired. Oh, my God.
He got fired for it. So anyhow, I wanted to talk to Vinick about it because he owned the Storm at the time. They had a news conference to announce a new logo for the Lightning. Well, I showed up at that news conference and everybody in the building, because I'd done the story the night before, knew what I wanted to ask. And Bill Wickett, the PR head or communication head for the Lightning, comes up to me and says, "We know why you're here. If you will refrain from asking the question during the news conference when we get our stuff out, I promise you Jeff will sit down and talk to you one-on-one afterwards." So
very nice.
Very nice. Now, I knew it was a gamble because he could have bolted, you know.
Right?
No, he could have. But right. I said to Wicked, if he does, I will hunt him down and get him. But anyhow,
right.
He was just – he was a man of his word, and he did exactly – what he said he would do. So yeah, I have great respect for him, and he was just terrific. So now that's my Vinick story. Listen, we're going to be running out of time. Before we do that, we have another hero from the Tampa Bay area. I don't know if you're familiar with Marty Baron. Marty Baron is now the editor of the Washington Post. Prior to that, he was the editor of the Boston Globe, which won the Pulitzer Prize for their story about the Catholic Church, and it was featured in the film Spotlight. Marty grew up on Davis Island, And actually, my wife grew up with him. And Cherezetic is featuring some of the people who were members of the temple as he was growing up, showcasing what they have done in their lives. And there was a big forum a week or so ago, and they just posted it. And I wanted to get a little clip of that, listening to Marty talking about being a journalist in Washington at the Post these days. So
cool.
Yeah, here's Marty Baron.
This past year has been a year unlike any of us at the Post has ever experienced. And I'm sure the same is true for all of you. But for us, the stories have been once in a lifetime events. At least we hope so. We had a worldwide pandemic, economic collapse, the largest social justice protests since the civil rights era, arguably the most consequential election of our time. And now an election aftermath that represents an unprecedented challenge to the fundamental underpinning of our democracy, which is the right to vote and to have your vote counted. These events have affected the staff at the Washington Post very personally, far more than even the biggest stories in a normal year. The pandemic has posed risks in journalists' personal and professional lives. They are often unable to interact with the public as they normally would. Work at home conditions are far short of ideal. Work is mixed with caring for infants or at home schooling. While the Washington Post did not cut staff or pay due to the economic crisis, some spouses and partners of our staff members saw their jobs evaporate and their incomes sharply reduced. That introduced a high degree of economic uncertainty in our staff's lives when work pressures were absolutely the greatest. Reporters, photographers, videographers, everyone were out in the field, especially those who provided accounts from within healthcare institutions or from street protests, and they assumed enormous risks. One of the risks with the protests was assaults from the police, who often treated journalists as hostile targets. The social justice protests themselves were deeply personal for many of our journalists, especially journalists of color who have experienced indignities because of race or ethnicity throughout their lives. Bigger picture, the public arena, which is the one where we operate, is just plain toxic. We are practicing journalism in one of the most anxious and polarized times in our country's history. I personally believe that we have moved beyond polarization into sectarian divisions. We've even seen what I would call sectarian violence. These persistent tensions and fractures in our society are really testing support for a free press and free expression itself. And the public's understanding about the role of the press in American democracy has severely eroded. That is the result, in significant part, of it's because of the unrelenting attacks from the president. Journalists have been labeled a lot, labeled garbage, scum, enemies of the people, traitors to this country. The president has sought to demean us, to delegitimize us, and even to dehumanize us. And beyond that, he has sought to disqualify independent arbiters of fact. And I'm not only talking about arbiters such as journalists, by the way, but judges, historians, doctors, and scientists too. And remarkably, he seems to have persuaded many of his supporters that there should be no arbiter of fact other than himself. So today we can't agree on the most basic facts. In truth, we can't even agree on what constitutes a fact. Traditionally, we've relied on certain things to determine what is factual. Things like, number one, education. Number two, expertise. Number three, experience. And number four, above all, evidence. But every single one of those has been devalued, has been dismissed, even been assailed as meaningless or suspect. And so today, the government's leading scientists find their motives questioned, their qualifications mocked, despite a lifetime of dedication and achievement that has made all of us in this country safer.
So he's an interesting guy. He's a really bright, bright man. And
but it's so amazing, you know, that we have this talent, this amazing local talent that comes out of Tampa. So just I love that.
Yeah.
Really extraordinary.
It really is. Let's see. There were a couple other things I wanted to get to. Oh, did you see?
Oh,
go ahead. We're almost out of time. Go ahead.
I was going to talk about Dubai. You know, yeah. So we had over 5,000 Israelis go in November, and apparently over 50,000 Israelis are slotted to visit the UAE, Dubai, in December. So, you know, and there was like all kinds of cute stories about, you know, them kibbutzing in Hebrew in Dubai. And so I had to share that because I love these little stories. I think this is so exciting. And Dubai, of course, has also said we have no problem with Israeli products. And I love this. So the head of Dubai's Chamber of Commerce was speaking as he was interviewed about the reason why he's not boycotting products from
the West Bank,
from Israel. And he said from the West Bank, and he said, listen, he's like, look, he noted that Israeli factories provide work for tens of thousands of Palestinians and said the hope is to assist the Palestinian economy rather than harm it. And he said, we are an open market in every sense of the word. And that means the broader the trade is, the more it is able to help various populations in the region, the better. So, you know, he's recognizing that, look, if we boycott, we're going to actually be harming the tens of thousands of Palestinian workers.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But listen, hear that music, Laureen? Believe it or not, we're out of time.
Oh, wow.
So happy Hanukkah, everybody. This is
happy Hanukkah.
This is Third Opinion. I'm Mike Thiessen.
Laureen Chappie.
Bye.
That's our pod for this week. Remember to subscribe to the Third Opinion podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, thanks for listening.